Okay, if we could come back. My weatherman tells me that I've got about an hour before the next storm hits, so. Of course, the other day when we delayed, he told me the rain would be gone by 8:15. That didn't happen either, so. All right. A couple of quick follow-ups on some things that were brought up during the break to me. About as far as the 10 days, somebody had brought up another thing they had read that if you started with the murder of Paul, if you started with the murder of Paul and counted forward, there was always persecution under the Roman government, but there were 10 intensive attempts to persecute the church by the Roman government. Perhaps it's referring to that. But again, you know, this we all agreed at the internet discussion that we really can't know. But something tells me that God would not have put that in there if those people hadn't have had a concept of what was going on. Because these letters seem to be somewhat tailored to each group. Another thought that was brought up, and this is a good one that I want to spend just a minute on. We live in a society today that if you listen to some of the real popular radio or televangelists or read some of the popular Christian reading material, they say if you are doing what God wants you to do, then you will be wealthy, you will be healthy, and your life will be good. Is that what God promises us? I can't find it. I can find it under Israel. Israel was promised that, and many times if you listen to them, that's where they go. They go to the Old Testament, they look at those promises of Israel. If you do what I ask you to do when you go into the land, I will bless you, and you will be great, and you will have everything you need. And if you don't, you'll be punished. And so we have, sometimes I think even in the church, taken that upon ourselves, and we have to be careful to understand that just because maybe I'm going through a rough time, maybe there's a problem going on, maybe there's a difficulty of some type that I'm dealing with, that doesn't mean that God is displeased with me. Doesn't mean He's unhappy. It doesn't mean I'm not being a spiritually minded person. It just means I live in the world and there's going to be problems. We're going to talk about that a little more later on, but I thought that was a really good comment because with these two churches, and we'll get to the second one in a minute, there's nothing He tells them they need to fix, but yet here they're going to suffer these persecutions. Okay, so we talked about the very short history of Philadelphia. So let's talk a little bit about the letter. Again, in verse 7, we have it to the angel. We have, this is chapter 3, verse 7, just to remind everybody where we're at. These things says, He who is holy, He who is true, He who has the key of David, He who opens and no one shuts, and shuts and no one opens. I know your works. See, I have set before you an open door and no one can shut it. For you have a little strength, have kept my word, and have not denied my name. Indeed, I will make those of the synagogue of Satan who say they are Jews and are not, but lie. Indeed, I will make them come and worship before your feet and to know that I have loved you. Because you have kept my command to persevere, I will also keep you from the hour of trial, which shall come upon the whole world, to test those who dwell on the earth. Behold, I come quickly. Hold fast what you have, that no one may take your crown. He who overcomes, I will make him a pillar in the temple of my God, and he shall go out no more. And I will write on him the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, the New Jerusalem, which comes down out of heaven from my God. And I will write on him my new name. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. Okay, so we have this description of Jesus here from Isaiah. He who has the key of David, he who opens the door and no one shuts, shuts and no one opens. That's some things Jesus said himself. It's very interesting to see that when his very next thing is, I know your works. We've talked about that in some other classes, I think. I know what you're doing. I know how you're behaving. I know your actions. I know what you're doing. I have set before you an open door. Now, in prophecy and in writings, an open door almost always refers to some kind of an opportunity. Almost always. I'll give you four examples. Acts chapter 14, verse 27. Now when they had come and gathered the church together, they reported all that God had done with them and that He had opened the door of faith to the Gentiles. 1 Corinthians 16:9. For a great and effective door is opened to me. 2 Corinthians 2:12. Furthermore, when I came to Troas to preach the gospel, and a door was opened to me by the Lord. Colossians 4:3. Meanwhile, praying for us also that God would open to us a door for the word. This is a constant in the Word of God, that an open door means some kind of an opportunity. So I think what God is trying to tell them is, I know what you're doing, and I've opened a door. There's going to be an opportunity for you. Something is going to happen. There's going to be an opportunity, but there's something special about this door. What's special about this door? No one's going to shut it. Why is no one going to shut it? Because God opened it. Because Christ is opening it, and he just said, if I open a door, nobody can shut it, and if I shut a door, nobody can open it. How many doors of opportunity are open to the churches today? Lots. Lots more maybe than we often think about. What scares me about my own work and my own life is how many doors has God opened for me and I've refused to walk through. I haven't walked through. I can't answer that question, and I'm kind of afraid to think of it too long. We have to be paying attention, because God does open doors sometimes, and if He's going to open a door and give us an opportunity to teach someone, to talk to someone, to be around someone, we have to be ready and willing to take advantage of that. I thought about whether I was going to use this example, and I think I am. Most of you know my father-in-law, Joe Dunn. They're not here this week. There were a lot of circumstances that led up to them not being able to be here this week. This is the first time they've ever missed the camp out since the first year. They've always been here. And for those of you that it seems odd not having them here. But I was talking to him on the phone the Wednesday before we were coming down here. And we were talking about several different things, but one of the things, I said something about, you know, it's really going to be different not having you there, and we're all going to miss you. And he said, yeah. But he said, you know, a young man called me the other day, and he was talking to me on the phone, and he said he'd visited just about every church in Carlinville, but he hadn't been to the Church of Christ and didn't know anything about him, and he wanted to talk to him about what the Church of Christ was about, what they stood for, and he had some questions for him over the phone, and if he answered those questions right, he'd want to meet with him. He talked to him for about 45 minutes, and the man on the other end of the phone said, you know, I want to get together sometime. And he told him, Lord willing, unless something changes, I'm going to be at church on Sunday. Did God open a door? And as difficult as it may be for them not to be here, you know what he told me? He said, maybe we're not there this year as much as we want to be, because somehow, some way, we're going to be able to help this young man. God opened a door. And he was willing to walk through it, even though it wasn't what he'd probably rather be doing at the moment, when he thought about it. But when he really thought about it, he knew, perhaps this is why I'm here and this is why I should stay. We have to be ready for those open doors. We have to be ready to walk through them. We have to be ready to take advantage of them whenever God opens them. He also talks about the fact that they have a little strength. Now again, this is going to be like that 10-year thing. I'm not sure we can completely comprehend exactly what he's talking about. I do think there's two possibilities, and they may both be true. And they may neither be true, I suppose. But I think they may both be true. This is a very small community. It still is today, if that's the branch of it that we know. This church may have been tiny in comparison to some of the others in the area. There may not have been a large population of Christians in this town. We don't know. It also may refer to the fact that they've been undergoing persecution and they're getting worn down and they're getting tired. And they've persevered well, they've done well, they've worked hard, they've done exactly what God wants them to do, but at some point you start to get tired, don't you? Especially if you're in a smaller group. Because so much of the load is laid on you, and so much of the load is laid on the people you are close to in the church. Because you don't have a large capacity of individuals to spread the work around, to spread the workload. So this could be their energy to go do things because they're getting tired. It could be the size of the group. I'm not really sure. But whatever it is, God's going to open this door. He's not going to allow Satan to shut it. And He's not going to allow the Jews to fight hard enough to keep them from accomplishing their goal. We have this synagogue of Satan again that we just talked about with Smyrna too, don't we? Same idea. So I'm not going to go into that any further. But notice that they are true to the word and to the name of Christ. Whatever this group of Christians has been facing, they have been successful. And God is not counting necessarily their success in the size of the church or in the effectiveness they've had in the community in converting people. He's measuring it in their spiritual strength, in their knowledge, and in their faith. That's what He's measuring it in. And when God measures them up to that stick, He seems pleased. If you're in a small congregation that you just feel like we're not growing, we're not accomplishing anything, we're not getting anything done, I'm tired, don't, like Randy was saying, don't quit. Don't give up. You never know when a door is going to be open to you. You never know when something is going to happen that's going to just open wide the church to the community and people will see and hear and respond. You never know. But if you give up, that opportunity might be gone. You can't give up. God is not measuring your success in how many seats and how many people are in the pews. That's not what He's measuring success on. We have this concept in our society today that the success of a religious organization is based on the number of people that claim it as their home spiritually. God doesn't measure it that way. God doesn't look on the outward. He looks on the inward. He wants to see how you're growing spiritually, how you're growing in the Word, how your faith is stronger, how you are working harder to be pleasing to Him. That's what he calls success. We talked about that the synagogue of Satan, the same group at Smyrna, is the one causing this persecution, according to verse 9. But notice what they're going to do at this congregation. Notice what's going to happen in this town. Something interesting. The enemy is going to worship. Something's going to happen. This is unique. Again, there's several things that this could mean. I think it cannot possibly mean that these enemies of God will worship the Christians in Philadelphia. Can't possibly be what it means. God does not condone that. He doesn't want it. He considers that the opposite of what He expects. Peter, you remember when he went to Cornelius. Cornelius, when he realized who Peter was, how did he react? How did he respond? He fell down on his face and began to worship Him. And how did Peter react to that? He didn't allow it. Get up. Get up. I'm just a man. God doesn't want us worshiping men. So it can't be that God is saying these people are going to come and fall down and worship you. That would have been counterintuitive to God's will. It could mean that they will worship in the presence of Christians. They will worship God. That's a possibility. Maybe that's the door that's being opened. It would indicate a mass conversion, wouldn't it? Which is possible. But I couldn't find anything else to confirm or deny that possibility. It also could mean that these people this enemy would come to respect and admire this group for their faith and their strength. Now, I ask this is an interesting question I ask in the high school class and in the junior high class. The high school class understood a little better what I was talking about. And I'm going to ask you the same question. How many of you have neighbors or co-workers or friends or people you know that are not Christians? They don't profess God in any way, shape, or form, but they respect you for the belief you have and for how strong you hold to that belief. How many have people around them you know that are like that? Yeah, I do too. Okay, I do too. And so perhaps, and this is the way I lean, even though I can't prove it one way or the other, perhaps this means that there's going to be a measure of respect of the Christians in this town, because notice he says he's going to keep them from a trial that's coming that's going to affect everybody else. He doesn't tell them they're not going to be persecuted at all, but it seems that the severity is going to be less among this congregation. Perhaps that's because those that would persecute them are, for some reason in this community, are going to have a measure or a level of respect and admiration for them, or at least a friendship or acquaintance with them, that they're not going to be as interested in persecuting them as severely. And perhaps that is the open door. They're going to have an opportunity not to be tested as difficultly. Again, notice that it says that it's going to be an hour. There's our second time frame. But this for sure, it can't mean an hour, literally. Again, it probably means a short period of time. Shorter than the 10 years, or 10 days, I should say, that Smyrna was told. A different time period, a shorter time period. Verse 11 is one that I find very interesting. I call it the don't get too comfortable verse. This is a congregation that's doing what they're supposed to do. They've just been told you're not going to be tested as severely as some of the other congregations, as some of the other churches. You're doing well. Things are going well. But hold fast to what you have. Don't get easy. Don't get too comfortable. Don't sit back and say, look, God's happy with us. We're done. No, that's not true. You're not done. There's still work to be done. You still have to hold that faith. Any minute, any time, this is to them, you could be the one from this congregation that is sought out for persecution and denies the Lord. As up in verse 8, he said, you kept my word and you have not denied my name. So far, they had held fast. But there was always the opportunity for them to deny. Always the opportunity for them to renounce their faith. Always the opportunity for them to go back against God one more time. He's pleased with their past victories, but they are not on easy street. This is definitely a warning we should heed. This is definitely a warning we should heed. We're gonna get into it in just a little bit, Lord willing, but we suffer some persecution in this country in particular, but we don't go through anything near what these people were having to face and deal with. And it's easy for us to sit back and rest on what we're doing and say, oh, well, we're doing good. Look at all these churches. Look at all the problems these churches had. Look at the problems that the Galatians had. Look at the problems that the Corinthians had. Look at the problems that so-and-so has. We don't have any of those problems. We're doing great. Yeah, we may be doing pretty good, but we've got our own problems. We've got our own things we have to deal with, our own issues we have to face. And if we don't stay alert and diligent about holding true and fast to what is the gospel and what is the doctrine of Christ, we can lose that as well. It can go by the wayside and we can get lazy and it'll just be gone. It'll just be gone. So that's a warning we should definitely heed. Verse 12. I think some of the very specific things to this congregation that we get, at least far as from the history part, come from this verse. He tells them that he's going to make them a pillar in the temple. You remember what physical, geographical problem plagued this area was volcanoes, and specifically earthquakes. This place, this town was destroyed over and over by earthquakes. People were scared to death. When an earthquake came, they ran out of the city. They got out. And if it happened enough and they got tired of it, they moved. They moved. Now, we move a lot today, right? People move. Some of us do. Some people don't move very often. Jill and I have moved a lot. We're good at it. But moving is not that difficult in our society, is it? You find some place to live, you rent a truck, you load your stuff up, you go. Moving in their day, in this first century, was a little more difficult. Was a little more trying. And it wasn't easy. Well, we don't think it's easy today, but it was really not easy then. And so they were having this problem of having to deal with all this stuff. And this is no doubt a reference to the earthquakes and the displacement that they were experiencing because of them. The population of this city was well aware of the importance of pillars in a structure. The pillars gave it strength, and God uses this imagery to show them that they are eventually going to have a permanent place to live that is unshakable and unmovable and safe, and that they're going to be a vital part of it by being a pillar. Because remember that a pillar not only holds itself up, it holds the rest of the building up. It's responsible for holding some of the things up around it. And so these people were given a good visual picture of how each individual was responsible to strengthen and hold themselves up, but also strengthen and help others around them to ease the load off of the other pillars, if you will. The more pillars that are in a building, the stronger the building is. The greater pressure and stress it can withstand. They are to be stable and strong now so they can enjoy the stability and strength of God later. They won't have to leave. They won't have to flee. They won't have to run. They won't have to be afraid. And these pillars are going to have something. They're going to have words on them. It's going to have the name. It's going to have the name of God. It's going to have the name of the city. It's going to have a new name. Written on them. It's going to have all these names written on them. Well, in this time period, when the Romans would put a pillar up, especially alongside a road, but even in a temple, on those pillars were written names of ownership. Okay? And whoever paid to build that pillar, they got to put their name on it. Does that happen in our society? We have a theater, a movie theater in Beloit, that the community raised money to build. And you could buy a seat. So you'll sit down in the theater, and on the seat back in front of you is a little golden plaque thing with somebody's name on it from the community, because they paid enough that they bought that seat. We laugh about sitting in people's seats, and if they show up, we might have to move. I haven't ever seen that happen. But we do that. When the Olympics, this was a long time ago, way back in the 1900s, but when the Olympics were in Atlanta, you remember that? My sister was living in Atlanta, and she paid to have, they had a brick walkway in kind of a common community area, and you could pay to have your name put on a brick. And she paid for each of our families to have their representation put on that brick, and I've got a copy of it sitting at home. Our name's in Atlanta someplace. I've never seen it. My mom and dad have. We do that in today's society too. What this is meaning is these pillars, not only are they going to be strong and strength and have a permanent home, but they're going to be gods. They're going to know exactly who their God is, exactly who they belong to, and it indicates the power and it indicates the protection of promise of God. God's going to protect them, He's going to secure them, He's going to build them up, and this is all based on their faith and belief and continuing until the end. Okay, I'm going to pause here for questions or comments on Philadelphia, some of the things we've talked about. Right up here.
I appreciate your comments, Doug. On the idea of the enemies coming down and worshiping before his feet, we have a couple of parallels in the Old Testament. Mm-hmm. Joseph and his brothers.
Yep.
Joseph had that dream, which they couldn't comprehend, you know, because he's a young brother. And how are we ever going to come and worship before your feet? But it was fulfilled in Joseph being exalted to power, and they depended on him for living. There's another verse in Isaiah that's good. Isaiah 49, verse 23. The And kings shall be thy nursing fathers, and their queens thy nursing mothers. They shall bow down to thee with their face toward the earth, and lick up the dust of thy feet. And thou shalt know that I am the Lord, for they shall not be ashamed that wait for me. So it's a promise that even though you're down now, there'll come a day when you'll be honored.
Right. It very well could refer to the judgment day, the end of time, when the enemies are punished and the godly are rewarded. That it very well could be a reference to that. Very good.
Yeah, I'll... I wanted to ask, is it possible to mistake an open door for a closed door and a closed door for an open door?
Sure, because we're not all-knowing. I think what you're talking about is the idea that I may feel there's an opportunity perhaps to have a study with somebody, and as I try to work with them and I find out that there's nothing there. And I may think that my neighbor isn't interested, and later on find out he was just waiting for me to ask him to talk about. Is that what you're talking about? And it's hard for me to tell the difference sometimes. Yeah. So what does that tell us? We have to always be ready. We have to be. That's why I think God gives us, or Jesus used that example of the sower. The sower was not walking around trying to find the best place and stick a seed in there and see what happened. He was just throwing it. Just throwing it out, see what happens, let's go with it. And who knows where the good ground is going to be and where the bad ground is going to be. I can't tell, so I'm just going to throw it out there and see. And that's what we have to be. We have to be seed slingers. Just get it out there, throw it, and see what happens. Because we can't tell. Sometimes we can't. Sometimes we can. Sometimes it's pretty obvious, and sometimes we just can't tell. So you're right. We can mistake one for the other from time to time. But I don't think God gets upset at me when I walk into a closed door. I think He gets upset at me when I walk by an open one. So we have. That's why I think we just have to be ready all the time to look for those opportunities.
Hello, Rick Hudson from Bloomfield, Indiana. I won't belabor this, but we have an older, extremely older gentleman in Bloomfield that is a former teacher, former preacher. He's not a member of the Church of Christ that I know of. Got a wrong number call from the state of California one day. And he has the habit in the grocery store, at the doctor's office, any place he is, of asking people upon their first meeting, "Have you been saved?" He got a wrong number, and he asked, after he convinced the lady that, "No, I'm really not the person you're trying to get a hold of," asked her if she'd been saved, and 3 hours later, on the phone conversation, he'd got her to grab a Bible, and he took her to scriptures, and she was in church someplace that Sunday morning. We have the idea of thinking no one wants to hear. And that was, I think, a great example of someone that dialed a wrong number that was still willing to listen.
Yep. There's opportunities everywhere if we look. Yep.
This is Dwayne Stoops. I think there is a way that we can know whether the door is opened or closed. But we have to be fully engaged with the Holy Spirit, that part of God that's within us. If we are fully engaged, we will know when a door opens. Now, the problem is staying fully engaged. We get too wound up in other earth things, mm-hmm. earth life things. But I think if we really stay in touch with the Spirit, walk in the Spirit, be engaged, invest in the Spirit, we will know.
Yeah, we'll see the opportunity when it comes, and we'll know it was open when we walk through it. Yep. Good.
I was wondering if you were going to comment on the connection between these two congregations not having any criticisms and being persecuted and not having any false teaching.
Yeah, that was how I was going to lead into the next segment. So we'll hold that thought for just a second. Are there any more comments? Oh, we do? Okay.
I just mentioned a couple things here. I wondered about this, when it says thou hast a little strength, where that's where there's a connection between that and I will keep you from the hour of temptation, that this may be a fulfillment of you won't be tested above what you're able.
I think there's definitely a connection, yeah. Whatever was going on with this group, whether it was size or weariness or whatever, they'd done as much as God thought they could do. And he was going to protect them. He was going to keep them from dealing with more than they could handle. Exactly like that promise. I think you're exactly on target. Yep. He's still going.
The other thing I was going to mention is that I think we have trouble not only identifying open doors because of how we define open doors. You know, Paul taught an awful lot of people that he never saw converted. Sometimes we're just a piece of the puzzle, and if we don't see the whole puzzle, we figure it must be a closed door.
Right. Yep. We may be planting, we may be watering, and we may be doing something in between. We have no idea. But if we don't do it, there's a step missing. Yep. Well, let's move on. I want to at least have about a half hour, right? About a half hour. Okay, good. They had asked me to talk about specifically about persecution. That seems to be something that connects these two groups. These two groups are connected by a couple of things. First of all, there doesn't seem to be any criticism of either of these groups. Again, not that they were perfect, not that they didn't have any problems, but God was pleased with what they were doing, and they didn't have anything major, especially in the area of false teaching. The other several, we talked about it yesterday, several of the other groups were admitting or at least tolerating false teachers in their midst, which were leading people down paths they shouldn't be going, leading them away from God instead of toward God. And these two groups, perhaps part of their works and their strength that they had done and their overcoming of the tribulation that they'd been through already, was kicking these teachers out, getting those teachings out of the congregation so they weren't there. And if they did that, that in alone fixed a lot of their problems. That solved a lot of the issues, just not having those false teachings present. That makes the road so much easier, which is something we should figure out within our groups as well. If we can keep the doctrine pure, if we can keep that doctrine true, if we can keep the false teachers at bay, whether they be through the TV or the radio or a book that they wrote, doesn't matter how they get into us, or the internet or whatever. If we can keep them at bay and out of our congregations, we have eliminated so many potential headaches and problems within our congregations that it makes life a lot easier. But we've got to be vigilant. You can't do that. You can't do that just hanging out together once in a while. You got to know each other. You got to know what people are thinking. You got to talk to one another. You got to study together more than just within the confines of the assemblies that we do together. Because it's outside of those assemblies that I've found, or noticed anyway, that the false teachings begin to enter in. This is what was being talked about, I believe, yesterday. Tom Dennis brought it up. John Lee talked about it. We don't really have an issue most of the time in our congregations with somebody standing up in the pulpit and explaining to us that baptism isn't necessary. They're not going to get away with that. Somebody is going to stand up and say, wait a minute, what about? And we're going to start discussing it. What we're going to have a problem with is members that maybe don't have the root system, maybe don't have the background, maybe don't have the teaching, that think that anything that goes by the phrase religious material is okay and is true. And anything they read on the internet must be true. And they're going to start thinking that through and understanding it that way. And the generation that comes up, or the generation after them, or the outside, I'm going to call it the outside fringes of the congregation, they're going to start to wither on the vine. And they're going to die. Well, that's what we have to watch out for. And in order to protect against that, we have to be ready to address those issues. And we have to be ready to confront those things head on in whatever way we can. The other thing that connects these congregations is persecution. They're both told there's going to be a persecution. Now, one's told you got to be faithful unto death because it's going to be bad. Smyrna. And one's told, you're going to have some persecution, but I'm going to protect you a little bit because you've already been through so much. That's Philadelphia. So the question was asked for me to address, is there persecution of Christians in the world today? Well, yeah. We hear about some of it. We hear about a lot of it. I just picked one page, some things that are going on overseas, some persecutions that had happened. I'm not going to read those to you because I think as adults, you're more aware of some of those things. You pick up on those things a little easier. I do want to point out one thing that I found from the Netherlands, from Holland, the Netherlands. Everybody knows what I'm talking about. It's that little country that they ride boats around a lot. In the Netherlands, they have, in their education system, they have religion classes in their public school system. You learn about the major world religions in this class, and everybody takes it. Every high school student takes it. This is something that is a borrowed quote from some of their materials. Some of the things that the teacher is expected to teach the student. Students are taught that Christianity would be abolished in the end, all other religions would disappear, and everybody will convert to Islam. After all, says the lesson, only Muslims can be good people. Every high school student in a public school in the Netherlands is taught that. Could that happen in the U.S.? In some ways it is. Not quite as overtly, but it definitely is. I asked both the teenage classes, the high school, college, and the junior high, I asked them that question, is there persecution of Christians in the world, outside the U.S., in the world? They all agreed, almost 100%, yep, there is. We know that. Then I asked them this question. I said, is there persecution of Christians in the U.S.? Does it go on? The high school class, those that shook their head and were willing to answer, were like, yeah, it does. It does. What amazed me, and I really wasn't expecting this, in the junior high class, there were three that said yes. All of the others said no. I didn't think there was. Then I started reading them some examples of persecution in the U.S. And guess what happened? The hands shot up and we had about 15 minutes of show and tell where they all had examples from their schools of things they knew had happened that they now understood was perhaps persecution, light persecution. They hadn't looked at it that way. They knew things were happening. They knew these stories. They knew what was going on. They hadn't seen it as persecution, because when we think of the word persecution in our mind, we think of Paul and we think of any of the others, Stephen. We think of Polycarp. We think of all the stuff that's happening overseas. But it's happening here in the U.S. today. It's just a little more under the table. I'm gonna talk to you about one in particular. We'll see if I want to take time to go into some more. I want to talk to you about one in particular from January 2008 that happened in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Some of you may have heard of this. I don't know. If you have, hang in there. If you haven't, you're about to get a little bit of an education. Two females, a lesbian couple, came to a husband and wife that had a photography studio, and they wanted them to take the pictures at their wedding ceremony. Now, homosexual marriage, same-sex marriage, is illegal in New Mexico. What they wanted to do wasn't even legal, but they wanted them to take pictures of it. The married couple that owned the photography studio said, no, you'll have to find somebody else. We're not going to do that. And somehow the concept came up that they just didn't believe that they should be allowed to get married, and so they weren't going to participate in this. The two women went out immediately within a couple of days, filed a lawsuit against them for refusing to take pictures of an illegal event. And the judge found in favor of the two women, and the couple was required to pay $6,600 in damages. Now, that case is on appeal. It hasn't been completely decided yet. The reason that I wanted to specifically bring that one up is that case prompted a group by the name of Wenzel Strategies to do a survey. Groups like to do surveys. And I have 4 pages of their survey material, and I'm not going to read you all of it. That's all the broken down statistics of, there were several questions they asked. This was the 4th question they asked on the survey. There is a trend developing in which gay activists are filing lawsuits against people who refuse to do business with them on moral or religious grounds, such as when a New Mexico photographer was sued by a lesbian couple for refusing to photograph their wedding. Knowing this, which of the following statements most clearly represents what you think about this? And their options were, such tactics are necessary, is persecution of Christians, or you're not sure. Okay? Well, I found 2 things interesting. The total group, okay, of the total group, and you want to look at this, you can, it's broke down into every conceivable breaking down of who's who and what's what and who thought what. But I just want to give you the total. 49% of those polled believed that that was persecution of Christians. They believed that was persecution of the, they were only being persecuted. However, 22% felt that such tactics were necessary. That yes, it was persecution of Christians, but it's necessary in our society today. And what does that tell us about the future? It tells us that we can expect a lot of persecution. I think that's what it tells us. We need to get ready. All these are just within the last few months, even in the U.S. There's a famous case called the Candy Cane case. Have you heard that? Where a young boy was singled out and banned from handing out candy cane pins with a religious message at his class's party. A little girl was threatened for handing out tickets to a religious play. And an entire class of kids were forbidden from writing Merry Christmas on holiday cards to American troops serving overseas. Now, I don't want to get into a debate of the whole Christmas thing. That's not my point. My point is that the reason they were not allowed to do those things because they were religious in nature. That case is going forward, and the interesting thing about that case is it's being argued on the grounds that grade school students, grade school age children, do not have a freedom of speech. That's what's being argued. If that case is won or lost, it's going to decide whether a grade school student has freedom of speech or not. If they decide that age students do not have freedom of speech, guess what that means? If your student says something that the teacher or principal doesn't like, or the government doesn't like, they could be thrown in jail because they don't have freedom of speech. Pretty important case. Pretty important case. And there's others. There was a preacher in Guilford, Arizona that was ordered to stop holding meetings or Bible studies in his private home. How many of you done that before? Okay. He was threatened out. Now, I have to say this. Since then, city regulation has been reviewed and rewritten so that that's no longer illegal. But he was threatened with prison for it. I just hate to read through all of these. Where is that one? I want to read that one. Ryan Dozier at Yuba College in Central California was handing out some tracts to the lunchtime crowd walking across campus. He was staying off the main walk, engaging in conversation, and shared his materials only with those students who expressed some interest. A campus policeman approached him and told him he'd need a permit to conduct such an assembly, and that he could be arrested and expelled. Shortly afterwards, he received a certified letter from college administrators reiterating the threat and advising Ryan that free speech was only allowed on Tuesdays and Thursdays between 12 and 1 with 2 weeks' notice in advance. That's a quote from the letter he received. Some nursing students that applied for a residency program at Vanderbilt University discovered that Vanderbilt required them to certify in writing that they would provide abortion services if asked. Required to provide in writing that they would do that, sign a document. A student in counseling, a graduate student in the counseling program at Augusta State University, when she debated the fact whether homosexuality was you were born that way or whether it was a choice, okay, that argument, and she argued that it was a choice, she was told by one of her advising teachers, you couldn't be a teacher, let alone a counselor, with those views. And if she wanted to stay in the program, she had a professional review. Those that are in college or have been in college understand what that means. You get to stand in front of your teachers and they get to tell you what's wrong with you and how you need to fix it. Okay? And she was told if she wanted to remain in the program, this is what she would have to do. Attend at least 3 workshops prior to the end of the fall semester, which would emphasize improving cross-cultural communication and developing multicultural competence or diversity sensitivity training toward working with the gay, lesbian, bi, whatever populations. And she was to provide evidence that she had gone to these conferences. She was to continue developing her knowledge by outside reading on the topic. She would read at least 10 articles in journals or peer-reviewed counseling writings, and they told her where to find these things. She was to work to increase her exposure and interaction with gay populations by attending a gay pride parade in Augusta and report on this. She was to familiarize herself with the accepted competencies for counseling these people. And each month, during the rest of her schooling, she was to submit a 2-page reflection paper to her advisor that summarizes, and listen to this, what she had learned from her research, how it had influenced her beliefs, and how her future clients may benefit. In other words, she was told, you have to change the way you think or we won't give you a degree. And that's just a few of the examples I could give you. Pages and pages. 2 Timothy chapter 3, verse 12 tells us, yes, and all who desire to live a godly life in Christ Jesus will suffer persecution. Did you know that? If you're living the godly life, you're going to be persecuted. There's going to be people that don't like it. There's going to be people that don't like it. So why are we shocked when it happens to us and other people? 1 Peter chapter 4, verse starting with verse 12. Beloved, do not think it strange concerning the fiery trial which is to try you, as though some strange thing has happened to you. But rejoice to the extent that you were able to partake of the Christ's sufferings, that when His glory is revealed, you may also be glad at His glory. Why are we shocked? We read those and we shake our head and we go, oh, I can't believe that happened. Why? Why can we not believe it happened? Satan isn't walking around hoping something happens. He's walking around like a roaring lion waiting to see who he can devour. He's going to be aggressive. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 32 proves to us that lots of other people, starting with verse 32, lots of other people have suffered persecution. So many that the writer of Hebrews got to the point in that chapter that he just said, I can't even go into all the stories. You go back and read them. Let me give you a list. 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 8. We are hard pressed on every side, yet not crushed. We are perplexed, but not in despair. Persecuted, but not forsaken. Struck down, but not destroyed. Always carrying about in the body the dying of our Lord Jesus, that the life of Jesus also may be manifest in our body. We are living proof that Jesus was persecuted. And because of that, people don't like it. Because if Jesus really was the Messiah, and He really did rise from the dead, then they really are responsible to believe and follow Him. And some people don't like that. And when they don't like that, they can't go after Jesus, although they try. They try to go after the Bible, but who do they go after? They go after those that believe. Remember when Lazarus was raised from the dead? The council got together. What can we do about this? What was one of the things they decided? We'll go kill Lazarus. If we take him, we'll get rid of the evidence. We'll get rid of the proof. We are the evidence and the proof that Jesus is Lord. And sometimes they don't like it. So what it comes down to is, how are we going to respond to that persecution? Because it's going to happen. We may not suffer to death, but I was talking with some, I think it might have been Wade, yesterday or the day before, and I've thought this for a long time. The longer I exist, the more I think it. I truly believe that in my lifespan, I won't guarantee that I'm alive at that point. I'm not that smart. I don't know. But I think in my natural lifespan, there will be a time when somebody standing up for what's right will be imprisoned for that stance. I really, truly believe that's going to happen. Did you know that the Bible in Canada is hate speech? There's certain parts of the Bible you're not allowed to read in Canada, at least publicly. There's a lot of people that, if they'd have heard me say some of the things that I've already said about homosexuality, if I was to stand up here and say what the Bible says, it's like in Romans 1 about it's not right and God's going to bring His vengeance down and wrath down upon these people, they would find me or try to put me in prison. I'm fully convinced that it may happen. I don't know that our society as it exists right now will allow persecution unto death. I'm not convinced of that. But at some point, you are going to have to decide, am I going to say what I know is the truth? Or am I going to say what will keep me out of trouble? And we're going to have to decide how deep our roots go. So how are we going to respond to those persecuting us? Romans chapter 12, verse 10. Be kindly affectionate to one another with brotherly love, in honor giving preference to one another, not lagging in diligence, fervent in spirit, serving the Lord, rejoicing in hope, patient in tribulation, continuing steadfastly in prayer, distributing to the needs of the saints, given to hospitality. Bless those who persecute you. Bless and do not curse. Rejoice with those who rejoice, weep with those who weep. We're supposed to hope for the best, to bless those that persecute me. Somebody treats me bad because of my belief, I'm supposed to pray that God will somehow bless them. Second, I'm supposed to understand that the persecution itself does not hinder me from serving God. It doesn't. Romans chapter 8, verse 35, who will separate me from the love of Christ? Remember that list? What's the first thing? Tribulation. Tribulation. Then it's distress. Then it's persecution. And then it gets to the physical things, famine. But persecution, distress, tribulation, those are the first three he mentions. Those cannot separate me from God. They can if I let them, but in and of themselves, they cannot. And finally, we're supposed to embrace the persecution and accept it. There's the hard part. Embrace the persecution. 2 Corinthians chapter 12, verse 10. Therefore I take pleasures in infirmities, in reproaches, in needs, in persecutions, in distresses for Christ's sake. Why? For when I'm weak, then I am strong. See, when persecution, when they fight against us, it causes us to have to decide what we believe and figure out how to prove what we believe. And when we do that, that makes us stronger. So persecution is not a bad thing. It's really not. Why is it not a bad thing? James chapter 1, verse 2. My brethren, count it all joy when you fall into various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience or perseverance. And let patience have its perfect work, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking nothing. Apparently, that comes after persecution. After I'm tested, that's when I can be complete. That's when I can... It brings a level of maturity, persecution does, that we can't reach without it. We cannot... It's that tree at D.D. Russell's house. It bit because it was never tested. If it had been tested over time as it grew, it wouldn't have fallen down. It wouldn't have been over. Remember that parable of the soils. We cannot be the seed in the stony places. We need those trials early on so that we develop those roots and that belief and that faith. 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 6. Well, I want to hit another one first. Well, no. Yeah, 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 6. We'll go there first. In this you greatly rejoice, though now for a little while, if need be, you have been grieved by various trials, that the genuineness of your... See that? The genuineness, the truthfulness, the reality of your faith, being much more precious than gold that perishes, though it is tested by fire, may be found to praise, honor, and glory at the revelation of Jesus Christ, whom you have not seen, you love. Though now you do not see Him, yet believing, you rejoice with joy inexpressible and full of glory, receiving the end of your faith. What is the end of your faith there? The salvation of your souls. That persecution brings a deeper understanding of the realness of our faith, which leads to the salvation of my soul. Step one, step two, step three. Revelation chapter 14, this will be the last verse that I'll bring up, and then I'll open it up for some last minute questions or comments. Revelation chapter 14, starting with verse 12. Here is the patience of the saints. Here are those who keep the commandments of God and the faith of Jesus. Then I heard a voice from heaven saying to me, write, blessed are the dead who die in the Lord from now on. Yes, says the Spirit, that they may rest from their labors and their works follow them. How we respond to persecution directly affects whether we hear, enter in, my good and faithful servant, or whether we hear, depart from me, I don't know who you are. It directly affects our salvation. So when you are persecuted, accept it, understand it has a purpose, embrace it, let it strengthen you, and let that strength bring a level of maturity in you that will lead eventually to your salvation and that crown of life. So you can be that pillar in the temple. So you can have that name written on you. I'm going to stop right now. I know we don't have a lot of time left. Until the classes come back, we'll open it up for questions or comments.
I appreciate the class a lot, Doug. I like Hebrews 13 and 4 or 3. Remember them that are in bonds as bound with them, and them which suffer adversity as being yourselves also in the body. So in a way, we are to be connected to anyone who's suffering,
right,
wherever they are, and remember them in prayer. It seems to me that the persecution was almost like an inoculation against false teaching. Because if you were willing to stay with the church, if you were that dedicated, I don't think you had an ear for false teaching. I think all you cared about was what Jesus said, and it was a great thing. And I'm glad you brought up the verses about not being surprised at persecution. The reason we're surprised is because we live in one of the greatest nations that there's ever been, and we weren't used to it. But now that it's coming in, it is kind of surprising because it's not the American way, and yet it's the way things are going.
Thank you for bringing that verse up. That was one the elders wanted me to cover, and I left it out. I had it in my notes, and I skipped over it when I was moving around. But yeah, we have to understand. When I read that verse, I think of that old saying, "There but by the grace of God go I." That could be us. That could be us being thrown in prison for proselytizing. I didn't read that one. I'm going to bring this one up. I'm not going to read the whole thing. But a man in, this happened May 30th this year, 2011, not too long ago. A man in Algeria was sentenced under the Algerian Penal Code, their actual law, Article 144 bis 2 of the Algerian Penal Code, which makes it a criminal offense to insult the Prophet or denigrate the creed and precepts of Islam. It's written in their laws. Could that happen here? Absolutely it could. It hasn't yet, but it could. I'm not going to predict it will, but it could. And we have to be ready for that. And it's just amazing to me that we forget. We don't. Ask yourself this question sometime, and you may not be able to answer it, but it's an interesting question to ask. If to get into the church building to meet with the saints on Sunday morning, you had to walk through a raining storm of rocks from people that didn't want you to go in, would you walk down the sidewalk? Would you go in? Would you take your kids? It's an interesting question. If we had severe persecution in the U.S. today, what would our churches look like? We got one.
I was in the Navy, and I was stationed in Philadelphia in 58. You're talking about these laws. That law has already existed to that city. If you did anything against the gay people, you were subject to arrest, fine, and whatever else that they can think of.
Mm-hmm. I forgot to read that. There's two more things I want to read to you. No, we'll just have one. Because sometimes we're not always losing. That's the part I want you to know. When these court cases come up, when these things happen, we're not always losing. June 27th, 2011. Just a few days ago, not very long ago. Indiana, those of you from Indiana, you can stand proud. An order was handed down by a federal court that upheld an Indiana law that requires women be informed that human life begins when a human ovum is fertilized by a human sperm. The order explained that the language crafted by the legislature in this provision supports a finding that the mandated statement refers exclusively to a growing organism that is a member of the Homo sapiens species. It is now law in Indiana that life begins at conception. We don't always lose, guys. We don't always lose. And because of that, we should continue to fight for what we know is right and true, and not give up, and be faithful unto death. The classes are coming back, and I know there's some more. If we can get, do we want to keep going, or you want? Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, as I think about the discussing how we're persecuted and so forth, I guess the fear for me, and maybe for others as well, is what our response will be when the persecution comes. Not only will I stand as far as not denying Christ, but will I dig a bunker and shut up? And, you know, there were people converted from jail when Paul was in jail. Just because if we're ever put in jail, just because you're in jail doesn't mean you're done.
That's right.
Sometimes I think the feeling is that we hear about possible persecutions and we want to dig a trench and drop into it, and that's not how Christ viewed persecution. Persecution, because it's not about us. It's about Christ and about God and about these people that are even doing it.
Right.
And we need to make sure we don't assume, you know, we often talk about the homosexual population. Because of the 1% who are screaming, doesn't mean that the 99% are absolutely clear in their minds about what's going on. There are those that are approachable as well. Mm-hmm. So don't assume things just because somebody says that they may be made that choice.
Right. Very good comment. Okay, I think we're going to have to close it down. So thank you for your comments. Thank you for your time. And go out there, fight the good fight. Never, 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 never give up. Fight to the end. Be faithful.